Dan Sagan.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We have a number of bills on the agenda today. The first bill is Senate File 372, Senator Gerlach. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I see you don't have any company.
I don't. I can rent some if I need to from somewhere here. But
go ahead.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I hope that this bill will just be brief and let you get on to larger matters of criminal justice. This bill here, in fact, maybe I could ask somebody or a co-author to move the bill.
We don't need to do that yet, Senator Gerlach.
We don't have a quorum yet?
Let's hear from you.
Okay.
Because there might be some robust discussions that might lead to other things.
So. Okay. All right. Well, members of the committee, Senate File 372, is a bill essentially to update our laws. I think it's a bill that's time has come. It's regarding ticket scalping. And the reason I say it's time has come is because technology and time has changed the marketplace dramatically. This is not simply about a black market or street corner vendors trying to make a buck. The internet has changed everything dramatically. There is a robust and growing secondary market for tickets for all sorts of venues. And it's the way I see this, and this bill was brought to me by State Representative Christy LaForest, who can help answer some questions. He's done a lot of research on this as well, if we need to. And I agreed with this when he brought it to me, and I said, absolutely, I'd carry it. And I picked up some additional authors, bipartisan support for this. And the point really is that things have changed. Times have changed. This law has been on our books, I read, since 1963. The internet has changed everything. And it's simply a difficult law to enforce, if not impossible. Police admit that it's very difficult to stop. I believe the private sector is better than government protecting the public as far as these transactions go. And really it is a private transaction. It's a contract. It's a valid contract between a willing buyer and a willing seller. There's no real public policy reason to void that transaction. At least no one's been able to come forward that I'm aware of with any reason to do so. Secondary markets are legitimate. I mean, we don't hear about scalping in real estate or stocks or art or baseball cards. And all of those things change value and people enter into these willing transactions. We still have plenty of consumer protection on the books in Chapter 325F. We have plenty of consumer protection laws for all sorts of things. I think consumers will not they won't pay more on the whole for tickets because the market is the market. It's impersonal, and it's probably better to have a open white market as opposed to a black market pushed underground. I think that that the public would be greater served and would have greater protections if the brokering market was legal. Brokers would have incentives to incorporate and act like any legitimate business and look out for the best interest of their consumers so that they can maintain their business. Certainly, government could regulate aspects of that. It'd be easier to weed out the bad actors and such if it was above ground. There are other elements to this, too. When you have an underground black market, it's not taxed. Certainly, if we have brokers in Wisconsin, it's legal, and we have brokers there that sell tickets to all sorts of events right across the border here in the Twin Cities. When that goes on here, we don't have the ability to really tax that if that's what we choose we might want to do. So those are some of the reasons there, and this bill has broad political support. We have bipartisan authors in both the House and the Senate. This bill did pass the House Public Safety Committee recently, and it passed the committee unanimously.
Madam Chair, Senator
Bensel,
we don't care what happened in the House.
Well,
we don't.
No, just if you want to tell us about the bills, but the Senate really does not care what the House does.
Well, I understand that, Madam Chair. I do personally. I have heard no reports or had any contacts of anybody in opposition to this bill, and nor has other folks in some other body which shall remain nameless.
Thank you, Senator Gerlach. Senator Betzold, before you your question, I just want to draw the members' attention to the bill. It is a very simple one-sentence bill, but I want you to flip it over and look on the other side to look at the language as being proposed to be repealed, so that you might want to take a look at that and see if you have any comments. Currently, members, the ticket scalping is a misdemeanor, and it is a misdemeanor. It's a punishable up to 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. And the definitions and the particular statute, again, is on the back of the bill. And so why don't you all take a look at that? Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, that's what I wish to comment on. I certainly agree that ticket scalping, people find creative ways around that. I mean, if I want to sell tickets over the face value, and if I just put a can of beer in there and say, well, the can of beer that I'm also selling is worth $100, in addition to the tickets, I've somehow avoided it. So I think people, it's not a law that probably needs to be on the books anymore or let the marketplace. However, you are correct, Madam Chair, that some of the things that's in here goes beyond ticket scalping. I'm particularly looking at what's the language of Subdivision 2, Subparagraph 1, because that law requires that tickets be printed in a conspicuous place, the price of the ticket, and the seat number, if any. Now, if that is repealed, is there any requirement that people who issue tickets for an event that has seating for it at an auditorium or a Metrodome, which has seating places, are they required to have seating numbers on them? Because I think that when you have counterfeit tickets and so forth, I mean, the way you were able to determine that there are counterfeit tickets are there when two people show up and they both got tickets for the same seat. Whereas if you don't have seat numbers printed on the tickets, then it'd be much harder to track that down. I'm just wondering why that particular part would be repealed.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Betzold. Let me attempt to answer both those the elements. The first element being the placing the price of the ticket on the ticket. That would be required to have an anti-scalping law, because otherwise how would you know if you're paying more than the face value? If we didn't care, if government doesn't have a public policy interest in that, having the price on the ticket, other than being a convenience that I think ticket sellers would want to do so that consumers would know, there's not a public policy reason to do that. As far as the seat number goes, I think the people who are putting on these events have a strong vested interest in making sure that you don't have multiple people, in the seat. It would be a very, very bad business practice to not put a seat number on a seat or on a ticket, because then you would have the problem that you're describing. So I think that the business doesn't need the government to tell them that you need to put a seat number on or you need to put the price on there. If we don't have the anti-scalping law in place, I think that it's self-regulating. Representative De La Forest wanted to add something to that.
Senator Betzel?
Well, just let me advise that I think that having a member of the other body coming and testifying as an expert witness is something that's not often done, Madam Chair. The representative has an opportunity in his own legislative body to testify. If he wants to come over here, maybe there's other ways to get to the Senate. But I think we should rely upon the Senate author to present the bill.
Senator Shack.
Madam Chair, because I looked at the statute this morning knowing that we were going to be considering this, and I saw that the bill was the simple repealer, I did look in statute and in 609 and read the elements of what constituted scalping and what the requirements were, and I actually, you can see I highlighted that same the same piece because I thought, well, it certainly is a good idea, but I thought, it sure doesn't. I don't think it belongs in 609 all by itself. You know, in and of itself, I don't think it should be a misdemeanor. And if I'm a consumer, I'm sure going to be looking for where the seat is in any case. If I'm going to particularly pay above the regular cost, I want to know where I'm sitting. And so I fortunately talked to a member of the other body before the committee meeting started. I talked to Representative De La Forest, and I mentioned that to him, and he pointed out to me, and I think probably he's onto something, that 325F, particularly .68, it has to do with prevention of consumer fraud. And I think if members look at that, using, you know, fraud, misrepresentation, deceptive practices, et cetera, is already unlawful already, and it's a gross misdemeanor. I'm not to misrepresent a product or an object that you're selling, then I think maybe it's covered. And I'm going to share this with Senator Betzel. Just I'd like him to look at it further. I haven't looked at it at length, but I think it's 325F. It deals with a lot of subjects in that particular section of statute, but I think that might cover his concern, because I was concerned about it, too, on first glance.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. And also, if I could add, too, that today tickets are all done barcoded, and that is you can't really counterfeit barcodes, and putting the seat number on, I understand, is, you know, 40 years old, an attempt to prevent the counterfeiting. But today we use the barcodes, but we don't say anything about the barcodes in the statute.
Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. Any further discussions on Senate File 372? Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'm curious on number four, subdivision two, number four. What type of selling of a ticket that you received restricting its transfer, did we initially intend to prevent and make a misdemeanor? I'm not sure why that is even in there.
Chair Senator Neville, I have no idea.
Anybody have had some clue significance what the 4 years history ago of number four is? I guess I don't have a problem repealing it because if somebody got a ticket, let's say that, I don't know, you won a ticket or you were gifted a ticket, but they said it belongs to you and nobody else. I don't know that should be a crime anyway. It's probably a civil matter, but.
Well, yeah, Senator Neville, I'm just thinking that perhaps at the time they may be contemplating situations where a nonprofit may have purchased bulk tickets for an event or something like that.
And sold it.
And may have marked it and didn't want it to be subject to, you know, somebody got a bunch of free tickets with a certain face value and gave it to the scalper.
Have been overreaching to make that a crime anyway.
Yeah. Senator Betzel.
Or it's possible, for instance, you may have somebody who has a season ticket and for whatever reason, disorderly conduct or whatever, you know, it's printed on the back of some tickets that, you know, that they reserve the right, you know, to revoke your season ticket rights. If, for instance, if you engage in behavior that they feel is detrimental, and if you then, I guess under these, if you try to transfer or sell your tickets knowing, you know, that they booted you out but you're still trying to sell it, maybe they're trying to have a hook in there saying that, you know, we're going to make it a misdemeanor for you to try to pander them. I don't know. But they have all this language on the back of the tickets that restrict the sale, you know, for them. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Neville,
in 15 years, I think we've only repealed that I can think of one or two criminal statutes. So this is amazing.
Well,
once we pass them, they would hardly ever repeal them.
Members, council just told me that
this is historic right here.
This law hasn't been amended in almost 30 years. So, well, it sounds to me like we are reaching a conclusion on the discussion. Pardon me? Anybody in the audience would like to testify on this bill? Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 372 be recommended to pass.
Senator Scheid moves that Senate File 372 be recommended to pass, and I think this goes to the floor.
I think so.
All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion passes.
Thank you.
One down.
Yeah.
Something wrong.
Second on the agenda is Senate File 302, Senator Foley. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pleased to be here. I've been carrying DUI legislation for years, and I was approached by Mr. Simon from the university, and we discussed some remedial things and things that I missed in some legislation past years. And, so what this is not a major change in the arrest and prosecution of DWI offenders, but something that is a little simpler. And what I'm going to do is to have Professor Steve Simon, the task force, and I have to look at Minnesota Criminal Justice System, DWI Task Force. And this is their legislation. Simon wants to be able to tell you what this bill will do.
Well, Professor Simon, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And by the way, just for the record, Professor Simons was my professor. So it's good to have you here.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity to appear before you. My name is Steve Simon. I am a clinical professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I am the director of the Minnesota Criminal Justice System DWI Task Force. Been in that position for many years, and have been before the committee for many years recommending many major changes to the DWI law. Today and this year, we're recommending what we call technical fixes. One of the benefits of the task force is that we have police officers, prosecutors, judges, representatives from the BCA and the AG's office, and they identify problems that occur in trying to work with the DWI law, and that's what happened here. Senate File 302 contains three major areas, addresses three major areas. Section 1 adds a person who is allowed to legally, not medically, but legally draw a sample for a DWI implied consent blood test, and that's phlebotomist. A phlebotomist is a person who's trained to do one thing and one thing alone, and that's basically draw blood samples. They were left out of the implied consent statute, so when an officer comes to the hospital with a DWI suspect, having invoked implied consent, and the person is chosen or the officer's elected a blood test, the hospital has to find somebody other than the person that they normally use to draw blood, to draw the blood from the DWI suspect. So this change in Section 1 merely allows them to use the phlebotomist, the person who is literally the most trained to draw that blood sample. Sections 2 through 5 and 8 through 9 make some changes to the CVO, the Criminal Vehicle Operation and Criminal Vehicle Homicide Statute, adding metabolites to the provisions of that statute that deal with driving with the presence of a controlled substance, Schedule 1 or 2. It adds the word metabolites to that language. Last year, the legislature added the word metabolites to the DWI law, and we inadvertently failed to also add that same metabolites language to the DWI provisions of the felony DWI law where there's an accident involving serious injury or death. One quick example of why we need metabolites, cocaine. If somebody takes cocaine, very powerful drug, the body metabolizes it so fast that by the time the officer stops the person and gets the test, which is usually probably an hour and a half or 2 hours later, the cocaine is gone. The body has processed it into what's the drug is gone, and all that's left are the metabolites. It makes it very difficult to successfully prosecute that person who's driving under the influence of cocaine because the cocaine, it affected them while they're driving, but by the time they get the blood test, only the metabolites are left. So these are clearly serious cases, and we're just asking that the CVO, CVH law be made consistent with the change that you made last year to the DWI controlled substances. Sections 6 and 7 have to do with the response to a recent case by the Minnesota Court of Appeals that has clarified the right of a person to have people who are testifying against them appear in person. 634.15 is a statute that addresses the admissibility of the results of a BCA analysis where that result is produced via a certificate prepared by the BCA. And 634.15 basically says that the certificate can come in and the person who worked at the BCA and did the analysis doesn't have to testify unless the person who's being prosecuted demands 10 days in advance that that person be present. The case said that that law, while it does allow a waiver, it implies a waiver of the right to confront the analyst, the law is not clear enough. The law should tell the person what happens if they don't demand the presence. And so the changes that are being made in that language basically do that. The prosecutor has to give a notice to the defendant that they have the results, and the law goes on to say that the notice has to say that if the person doesn't demand the presence, that the certificate comes in. So it's not changing the basic policy in 634.15, which allows the results to come in by certificate. It's just clarifying the information given to the defendant, what happens if they don't demand it. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Any questions for Senator Foley and Professor? We have someone else on the list to testify. Is that to testify in opposition to or in support of the bill? Mr. Springer?
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I might, I just wondered, I mean, I obviously can read the repealer, but I don't know.
Thank you for pointing that out. Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, when we brought this attention to the author and then when it was the drafter, Mr. Backus pointed out that the CVO, the 609 criminal vehicle operation, criminal vehicle homicide provision, is poorly drafted. It's difficult to make changes to it as we're doing this year. And so he has drafted a recodification, making no policy changes, but making it much easier to work with. Because the law, as you folks well know, is an evolutionary thing, constantly being changed in response to either policy changes or court decisions. This makes future changes much easier.
Thank you.
Mr. Backus, I'd like to give him credit for recognizing that, it makes his job, it also makes your job much easier.
Thank you.
Is that satisfactory, Senator Scheid? Mr. Springer, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Urschel Springer. I am the Assistant Director of the BCA Forensic Science Laboratory in St. Paul. My comments will be very brief. I also would like to take this opportunity to say that the BCA lab also supports Senate File 302 for the very reasons that Professor Simon has stated. With the recent court decision, the 634.15 has the potential of pulling our scientists into court when it's not being contested, and when we're away from the lab, we can't do our work, and we can't keep up with the backlog. So I believe the language provides a mechanism that gives the defense a chance to talk to the prosecution and request our presence, and if that occurs, we will be there.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Springer or Professor Simon? Is there anybody else in the audience who would like to either testify for or in opposition to this bill?
Senator
Neville.
If there isn't, I have an A1 amendment that I'd like to offer and have distributed. I'm sorry, I guess it's an A2 amendment. It's A2.
A2.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll let it get to the member, Senator Neville. On the A2 amendment, Senator Neville.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members, this
This amendment makes an additional change to the criminal vehicular negligence statute, and it arises out of two cases. I'll try to briefly summarize it. A number of years back, it's probably 5 or 6 years ago, I had a constituent whose daughter was driving on Highway 13 in Le Sueur County. Someone was driving the other direction with a farm trailer without safety chains on it. The trailer came loose, and the trailer crossed the center line and decapitated her daughter's and killed a granddaughter. And the most that the person could be charged with was careless driving. There's the second case is one that's actually more recent in Rice County, where a farmer was driving a tractor on a road, pulling a trailer that didn't have any reflectors, and the trailer was wider than the tractor, and another car was coming from the other direction and hit the trailer because there were no lights or reflectors on it, and died as well. I introduced a bill a number of years ago that did exactly this change. It passed out of Judiciary Committee and Transportation Committee and passed by the Senate as well, but we could not get the House to pass it. Sorry, Senator Betzel, I mentioned the House. But the Senate has already acted favorably on this language, and what this language does is add the concept, and we're doing it through the definitional section, that grossly negligent, first of all, it changes the definition of motor vehicles to add including attached trailers. That's the first. And then the second one is it adds to the definition of gross negligence if you drive while knowing that the vehicle is maintained in a manner that creates a significant risk of death or bodily harm. So if you are driving a vehicle with a trailer on it and you have knowledge, actual knowledge, that there's a condition, if it's this could apply to other things. For example, if you're driving your car and you know it doesn't have headlights, if you're driving your car and you know your brakes are bad and you kill somebody, it won't. That would constitute gross negligence and you could be charged under the statute. So I'd like to offer that. It fits in with this criminal vehicular negligence bill. And unfortunately, I don't have the same witnesses back here to testify, but they provided very compelling testimony a number of years ago.
Madam
Chair, Senator Foley.
I would support the amendment.
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
It does strike me that this may have a fiscal impact, though. So, Senator Foley, that may cause your bill to go to the Finance Committee. I don't know if the rest of the bill does, but, you know, if this is going to create, however, many or few, there would be a fiscal impact, from what I can say, and your bill is going to get detoured, I think, if the amendment goes on.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
I would argue it doesn't have a fiscal. It didn't go through a fiscal committee 4 years ago. Trying to come up with a bid impact on this would be pretty difficult. But if it does, I mean, I'm sure that it would be nominal. So I would argue that this can go on without having to go through a finance committee. It's purely a policy change.
Mr. Turner, in the last, did this bill go through? Well, let me ask you this. Senator Neville, did this bill go through? You said it didn't go through a finance.
It didn't have to go through finance. I wish I knew exactly what year it was. 4, 5, 6 years ago that I initially had this language.
I believe that was in 2000, Senator Neville.
2000? Okay. 7 years ago.
Any further discussion? Senator
flies.
Higgins?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I'm looking at lines 1.14 and 15.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of standard is that? If this is a trailer and somebody doesn't have the reflectors on it that they're supposed to have, or that kind of thing, would that be enough to put it into this category? I just plain don't know.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, it always depends on the circumstances. I designed this so that it would apply to a case where a person is driving a trailer without safety chains on it and the trailer comes loose.
Mm-hmm.
If you can show that a person has actual knowledge that he's driving a vehicle on a roadway and the vehicle or the trailer is knowingly in bad condition and the state can prove that because of that, someone's life or safety would be at risk, that would be sufficient. But everything depends on the facts. If you give me a specific factual scenario, I could probably evaluate it. But
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, how
Senator
about
Higgins.
How about a tractor pulling a farm trailer of some sort?
Well, that was one of the scenarios that led to this as well, because we do have, you know, the fact scenario that I am personally aware of is a farm tractor pulling a trailer that didn't have lights or reflectors on it and was wide enough so that another vehicle couldn't see it and drove into it.
Okay.
And I would expect it to apply in a case like that, where they can, where the state has to show actual knowledge by the person who's driving the vehicle.
Senator Limmer?
On another issue.
Oh, on this point, Senator Betzel?
Well, I have another issue, too.
Oh, so. Senator Olson, is that on this point?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, and perhaps I should know this off the top of my head, but if you, without having access to the statutes right in front of me, do you know whether gross negligence is defined specifically by statute anywhere else? And because I know there's a body of case law that's developed around the concept of gross negligence, and my concern would be that somehow we're impacting that body of case law by appearing to somehow either limit or define statutorily something that might be making a bigger change in the law than we're realizing by including this language?
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, that's a good question, and I should have covered that initially. If you look at line 1.13, it's my recollection, and Senate Counsel can check me if I'm not correct on this. We don't include a definition in the statute of gross negligence, but the courts have defined it in CRIMJIG, the jury instruction guide, to be exactly what line 113 is. So that the definition that courts use when they're instructing juries of what is gross negligence, that's what line 1.13 is, with great negligence or without even scant care. I just took the language from the CRIMJIG and put it in. And then in addition, I added line 114. So that applies for the situation where you have the equipment violation in a knowing manner. So I will say my intent is not to change the standard or the definition for gross negligence, except to add to it that second parenthesis. So this, in my view, this would not have any change on existing law except to add to it. Senate Counsel, did I describe that correctly as far as you know?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, members, yes, I believe that's correct. I don't believe it's defined in statute, and I have the CRIMJIGs in front of me, and it does talk about with very great negligence or without even scant care.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my question, too, but more importantly, specifically, the even scant care standard. I hadn't remembered that was legal parlance in our statutes, and I was just wondering if there's a reference. I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
Senator Betzel.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I do get a little concerned about issues that I think are probably introduced as bills, just in case there's anybody out there has an interest in them. Did this, Senator Neville, go to any other committees, like the Transportation Committee?
Senator Neville?
Okay. I can't remember, but Senate Counsel reminds me not.
It was only the Crime Prevention Committee, apparently? Okay.
I think so, yes.
Senator Neville, if it had gone through the committee and went to the floor, how come you didn't just do it as a bill?
I did do it as a bill then. I didn't do it as a bill now because this was a pretty good – it was the same statute. And I suppose I could have, but I saw an opportunity, and I discussed it with Senator Foley, and it was okay with him.
And Senator Neville, I'm a little bit concerned because I think we could sit here and hypothesize the potential situations that would be covered under this, and I'm thinking that in the instance of, you know, moving trucks and moving vans, I mean, they're moving big refrigerators and items, and they know that they're moving, and even though they try to strap it down and try to do what they can, we know that things come loose and it comes undone. What would I guess we would mitigate against knowing that they are creating a significant risk of death or great bodily harm to another person in those circumstances.
Well, Madam Chair, first of all, I think semi-trucks are already covered under the current law under the definition of motor vehicle. But and so what this is really intended to get is the actual condition or the maintenance of the vehicle itself. I don't intend this really to deal with things where refrigerators are not buckled in. It's the equipment itself.
Okay.
And I believe that's the way that it's intended to be drafted. So, I mean, it's intended, you know, if you've got either a trailer or the vehicle that has a knowingly defective condition and you go on the road anyway and drive it.
Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this amendment, either for it or in opposition to?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Senator Neville, if I might. Senator Neville, I don't pull trailers because I can't back up with them, so it takes you way out of your way when you can only grow forward. Is there a law someplace that says you have to have that chained? I just yeah. don't know. Okay, so yes. that is a law. All right, well then, it's a good thing I don't drive trailers.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, just for the committee members, just to give you another example of where I can see this might come into play quite frequently is in the case where people's brakes fail because there are requirements for checking brakes that not everyone follows. And you do say that it has to be knowingly maintained in a manner that creates a significant risk, but I can see where that might be kind of a fine line for people. And I would point out that I think that when you put into place standards, even though this is for with respect to a criminal offense, that does have civil ramifications generally as well. So I guess I just want to point that out. And because of the case law that defines, because we're taking a pretty big step in giving a statutory definition to something that has a lot of case law surrounding it, I would be more comfortable if it said something like includes but is not limited to in defining gross negligence, just so that we're not somehow sending the message that this is the statutory, you know, kind of limited standard of how we're defining gross negligence.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, I think that would be more problematic if we were to put that in. We don't have a statutory definition of gross negligence, so the courts have basically crafted it by court decision. And they've come up with the definition of line 1.13. That's the standard right now. And if we were to put in including but not limited to, that could actually create confusion and potential defenses. It might mean something more. It might mean something less. So I think the intent of drafting it this way was to make it clear that we're preserving the current standard and all we're doing is putting it in language instead of having to do it in crimjig, but then adding one specific additional criteria, just like we have for drunk driving. I mean, we define you commit criminal vehicular negligence or homicide either by driving in a grossly negligent manner or by driving while drunk. Some people might argue that if you're that you could be over 0.08 and still be in total control of the car. So we had to specifically add that to the statute, and it doesn't matter if you could argue that it didn't impair me or not. If you're at 0.08, you've committed criminal vehicular negligence anyway. So that's kind of what I'm doing here, is adding one more criteria or standard.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Do you know whether the civil jig standard mirrors the criminal jig standard?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
And Senator Olson. I don't think that there's any, there's any concern here on the criminal side, because on the civil side, it's a regular negligence standard anyway. You know, here we're only talking about a higher standard of proof and a higher standard of gross negligence, even in the cases that I told you about where the chains came loose. It didn't. I mean, there was still a big civil lawsuit, I can assure you of that, because there was still negligence.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, except if it's gross negligence, then you've got some higher penalties involved and possibly punitive damages that would result because of it being gross negligence. So I guess I'm just, again, I'm just wondering if you'd know if the civil jig is the same, or if there's some way, if it's not the same, that we make it clear that we're not intending to change that definition or impact that definition.
Yeah. Well,
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, my intent isn't to change the civil standard at all. To the extent that somebody would argue for punitive damages, the statute already defines that it has to be clear and convincing evidence of willful disregard for the rights or safety of others. And so this one won't change either the basic civil standard or the punitive damage standard, in my opinion.
If any.
So, Senator Neville, as it pertains to the maintenance of the actual equipment itself, so this would apply in a situation where, as Senator Olson has said, if there were badly maintained brakes or broken headlights or turn signals that went unfixed or maybe a cracked windshield wiper. I mean, that would be included in this.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville.
What this language does, first you have to show knowledge. Second, you have to show that it relates to the maintenance of the vehicle. And thirdly, they have to show that it also created a significant risk of death or great bodily harm. So a cracked window might not meet that test, or a bad windshield wiper, but depending on the circumstances. So, I mean, we can't envision all the circumstances here, but the elements of the crime would add those factors. State has to prove them all. And, I mean, if you're telling me that a cracked windshield on a clear day, I would say that clearly by itself doesn't cause it. But if you're going out in a blinding rainstorm and you know your windshield wipers don't work, that might do it.
Any further discussions on the A2 amendment? Senator Neville.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to move adoption of the A2 amendment.
All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Now, is there anybody here who would like to testify further now on Senate File 302 as amended? Senator Foley, what is your wish?
I would move that this Senate File 302 would be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Senator Foley moves that Senate File 302 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Congratulations, Senator Foley. The next bill on our agenda is Senate File 212. Senator Fischbach, are you here? Senator Fischbach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I am sat on judiciary for a short time, Madam Chair, and was just, you know, having flashbacks as I sat waiting for my bill. Madam Chair, if you're ready, this Senate file is fairly self-explanatory. What it does is it adds...
Senator Fischbach?
Oh, I'm sorry.
We seem to have two different bills here. It's 212, it looks like it's one page, and it's attached 211.
Just one of my bills.
We don't have 211 before us.
Elections, early voting.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a great bill, though.
Members, the bill should just be the one on the one side. Okay. Unless you insist that we get you the whole bill, but I think it's just a page one. And the other one is not before us, so. Let the record reflect that we don't have 211 before us. This is 212. Sorry, Senator Fischbach. Please continue.
And, Madam Chair, just for clarification, the bill I've got, it's one page, lines 1 through 21. So it ends, I don't know how it looks on yours. I've got a different one. So, Oh, you get multiple pages. Wonderful. But, Madam Chair, this just creates an exception in the existing carbon monoxide alarm bill that would create an exception for an all-electric single-family dwelling, and then they define what an all-electric dwelling is, and basically they would not have to install the carbon monoxide alarms like we passed. I think it was last year that this was passed in 06. So just creating another exception, the small carve-out for that.
Senator Fischbach, this bill has passed the committee before in previous years?
Madam Chair, no. The requirement passed. For the carbon monoxide alarms just passed last year.
Yeah. You're creating an exception for
yes.
the all-electric single-family dwellings.
Yep.
Senator Fischbach, in those homes, do they have could they potentially have things like fireplaces or, you know, portable heaters or, I don't know,
Madam Chair,
things like that that might
yes.
have be
yes,
gas-operated?
They could potentially have those things unless if there was someone who wanted to put together language that would, you know, if you have those things, I guess it gets a little kind of cumbersome. But this was brought to my attention by a constituent who's got an all-electric home. Unfortunately, he was unable to be here today. It's actually his birthday, so he was at home with his kids today. But he did point out that, you know, that in an all-electric home, they spend a lot of money to make it all-electric so they don't run these risks. And it's a fairly tight home, so the garage issue, I know that was brought to my attention. So, you know, I will work with the committee if there's interest in putting those, you know, making those kinds of I don't want to say exceptions on top of exceptions, but making those kinds of things, if they have a wood-burning fireplace, then it doesn't qualify if we want to, you know, expand that definition.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I'm just thinking out loud. Why is this in this committee? Usually this type of building code stuff goes into our local government committee. Why are we in? What's the reason we have it in judiciary, the jurisdiction?
Senator Limmer, I believe that this falls under our chapter.
Oh, it does.
That's within this jurisdiction. Senator Limmer, I asked the same question, actually, and counsel said that.
You
so.
And I are thinking the same again.
Senator Betzel.
Well, another question, and Senator Fischbach, you did mention garages, but if somebody has a tuck-under garage, and for whatever reason, and I recall one tragic situation where somebody, you know, tried to, you know, successfully actually killed himself, by getting this car, closing the garage doors, turning on the car, and sitting in there. But he killed everybody else in the house because the exhaust seeped into the house, and the family was sleeping, and they died as well, too. The fact that you have an all-electric single-family dwelling, how would that prevent that situation?
Senator Fischbach.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, in particular in that situation, I guess I can't address someone who is trying to commit suicide. I mean, that's difficult for me. I mean, if you're talking about someone who has a garage that could potentially, you know, if they accidentally leave the car running and they're not, and their intention is not necessarily to kill themselves, but from what I understand, and I'm no electric, all-electric house expert, but my understanding is those houses are tightly sealed because of the cost of electricity, and so that hopefully that there wouldn't be seepage into the house on a garage or from a garage.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, the situation I cited was a suicide, but it could happen. You know, just somebody who's bringing the groceries in for whatever reason, gets distracted, the phone rings, the car's out there running, and carbon monoxide comes in the house. I'm not so convinced that just because you have an all-electric single-family dwelling that you are then immune from the effects of carbon monoxide poisoning. And why should we say that, you know, we should not want alarms installed in dwellings? you know, I'm struggling because I don't know enough about it, you know, to say that this is a good idea.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, and I thought maybe Senator Betzold was going to refer to a situation that I'm aware of that happened in Brooklyn Park, but it's a long time ago. But it happened in the summer. A mom committed suicide, and her two children inside the house were, they succumbed also. And she, you know, it was pretty clear she didn't intend that. And that was the summertime, so it didn't have anything to do with, you know, heat being, and I, you know, you could, I suppose you could say, well, would the children have known about the alarm? I mean, all of those things. I think we're even learning more about the alarms versus monitors, as a matter of fact, and where they should be placed, and if anybody can even hear them if it's an alarm. But I get a, I can understand not requiring this. Or you'd feel that way in an all-electric dwelling, but it makes me a little nervous maybe that it should be more narrowly drawn. I don't know, and I'm not, and I don't have a suggestion right now.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Backus. Is this section only dealing with new construction? Because, you know, back in the 70s when I first moved here, there's 100 years ago, you know, I rented a room in an all-electric house in St. Louis Park. It was built in the, you know, well, start of it was built right after World War II, and then it kind of expanded on. But it was in, 1870s, yeah.
100 years ago.
But it was an all-electric home, and it had a couple of fireplaces, but it had a tuck-under garage and all those, you know, kinds of things that we've been talking about. And, you know, I kind of think it probably should have some sort of carbon monoxide detector in a home, just if nothing else, just because of its age, you know.
Senator Higgins, I don't think it's limited to just new constructions, but Mr. Backus could clarify for us.
Madam Chair and members, I'm just looking it up in last year's session law, but I believe the effective date for this was kind of phased in. I believe that it originally was effective, I think it was January 1st, 07, for all newly constructed single-family and multifamily dwellings for which building permits were issued on or after January 1, 07, and then August 1st, 08, for all existing single-family dwelling units. So I think it's phased in, but I'll double-check that.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Fischbach, another example of where carbon monoxide sometimes gets into homes that I just point out is in situations where people lose electricity. I remember going through the Grand Forks flood with a home, and all the propane heaters in the area were sold out because people brought those heaters in to provide heat in their home and to dry out homes. And so when you have flooding or you have a loss of electricity, you bring in things into the home that generate carbon monoxide, and that might be a concern.
Oh God, yes.
Well, and Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
If those are concerns, you know, we might take a look at the exceptions. We already have several exceptions, one of them including if you look at B and C, just above, you know, lines 13 through 18. If we take a look at those, there are exceptions to it. So there are those questions that could be asked and all of those worst-case scenarios that could be presented here. And I guess we're just the constituent approached me and asked if we could take a look at this, and I appreciate the discussion of the committee, but there are already exceptions to these to the requirements, and this, I think, is a reasonable request when it's an all-electric home.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This reminds me of years ago I did a lot of work in building code legislation as well as carbon monoxide legislation as well. One of the concerns that new builders have is that they're building homes. That's why it's strictly written, the ongoing chapter is written for new homes, is that new homes are being built much tighter than older homes. And older homes are a little more drafty. They have a lot more seepage through walls for air filtration to continue. In many ways, they're much healthier than the new homes. But because we have these new new standards for sealing a home, we're trapping anything that's in that home, anything that generates, whether it's oxygen or carbon monoxide or carbon dioxide. You don't have necessarily an opportunity to expel that. And so the new homes have air exchangers that are mechanical devices to bring in fresh air. It tempers the air, and then it draws out the old air out of the house. One of the problems that I see with this particular bill, and it could be corrected, is if you have an attached garage. A lot of people, it's common in Minnesota to go out and start your car and warm it up. And a lot of people don't bring the car outside to let it warm up. They leave it in the garage. I've been known to do that myself in my own house, but I have a carbon monoxide detector in it, and it's amazing that after 15 minutes, I'm getting a reading on my carbon monoxide device. Now, I have a home that's built in 1979, and so it's a fairly drafty home. But even being a drafty home, it's allowing that filtration of carbon monoxide to come in through what should be an exterior wall, the wall between the garage and the house. That's considered an exterior wall. We insulate it in Minnesota the same way we do an outside wall. And one could make an exception to this provision if you said that the house, only if the house had a detached garage. However, that still doesn't alleviate the other concerns of other devices in the home that may be like a stove or a furnace of some sort. Usually our building codes would expect that some type of carbon monoxide detector be in the house if those were introduced, if it wasn't built that way. I was just wondering, did you have an opportunity to maybe review this with our building standards and codes agency with Department of Administration? They love these kind of bills. And
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no. But I have been, they have not contacted, the bill has been introduced, and I haven't been contacted either.
Well, members, I think that there's a public policy implication here that we should think about, which is that the reason why we put the carbon monoxide laws into law is because we are concerned about consumer protection. And while I think Senator Fischbach has good intentions in trying to be responsive to her constituent, it certainly is raising some concerns among committee members as we are engaging in the discussion that if we were to take care of the specific concerns and, you know, the attached garage, the use of portable heaters, et cetera, we might be then creating a whole list of exceptions that at the end of the day is that, you know, it becomes so cumbersome that we should then think about, is it really worthwhile from a policy standpoint for us to make this exception and create a whole bunch of other exceptions to it? So we have one or two options in front of us. I think, you know, we should back up a little bit and think about, from a public policy standpoint, we've put the carbon monoxide statutes in place for consumer protection. You know, should we just make it applicable all across? Because the intention is to kind of have a catch-all for those circumstances where this will happen. Or if there is a desire on the part of this committee to make an exception for all electric family dwellings, then I would ask Senator Fischbach to lay this bill over and to work with members on their specific concerns and try to see if we can come back with an amendment. My inclination is that we've put the laws in place to protect and to catch all those potential situations. And so, you know, I put that out for the committee to think about or for our discussion.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Fischbach.
As we're looking at it, and if we're going to, you know, give it some thought, I was just wondering if, you know, in the subdivision B or this B section starting on line 13, where it says an owner of a multifamily dwelling that contains minimal or no sources of carbon monoxide, I'm just wondering, you know, we've made that exception already. That's existing law. Is there a way that the committee, if we worked with that existing language to see if there was some way to work a single-family dwelling into that, because we've made that exception for apartment buildings, for multifamily dwellings. So if there's a way that we could work this in. And maybe that's it can just be part of the discussion, but I'm wondering if that would be something the committee would be interested in also.
Senator Fish, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm just looking. You called attention, Senator Fischbach, to the exceptions. Why would we have ever made an exception for facilities owned or operated by the state? What were we thinking?
Or multiple dwellings.
Exactly. That's
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Higgins, for pointing that out, too, because I was going to say it.
Members, why don't we, Senator Fischbach, you understand the discussion and the direction we're going.
Yeah, absolutely, Madam Chair.
I think that let's lay the bill over,
thank you.
We will have you work with specific members of the committee and with Senate counsel to see if we can address some of the concerns that have surfaced. And then we'll bring you back in front of the committee.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senate File 212 is been laid over.
So that I could say to my constituent, there's no exceptions because I was
members. I was going to make this point when we first got together at the beginning of the session, but Senator Fischbach's bill is a pretty small bill, and, on its face it looks like it's pretty harmless, but once you take a look at it, it could bring up some issues. So for those of you who are members in this committee and you're going to have bills coming before the committee, as well as for members out there who have bills on track coming here, I would strongly encourage everyone, if you haven't done so, to really work your bill with the members of the committee. Because as the session progresses and as the deadlines draw near, we will have a lot of bills that we will be hearing. And I would, as a chair, give deference and consideration to members who have taken the time to really work the committee members to let them know what's in your bills. I think that that's a courtesy, and I think that in order for this committee to run, I think you should just talk to the members in the committee and make sure that people understand the bills. Again, both for members of this committee, but for those who have bills coming to this committee. Senator Higgins, Senate File 300.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Foley has a question.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I agree with what you're saying. What I would hope would be that members of the committee that do have amendments might contact the author and go over the thing with them before trying to do that after we're once in session.
Very well said, Senator Foley, and that's the one piece that I left out. And once we get into a deadline, this committee has very broad jurisdiction, and we will have a lot of work, not only as committee of origin, but there will be a lot of bills that will be referred to us. And if people have controversial amendments that they have not worked out with the authors, that will not that as a committee we don't want to have an opportunity to give the bills and the amendments due consideration. But I would strongly encourage members to work with the authors, because if it gets to the point where we're rewriting bills in committee, I will lay those bills over. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
On that point, we seem to have a lot of discussion about the majority party talking and dictating terms about amendments. And those of us in the minority take that rather personal. Anyone who has a substantive amendment certainly should bring it to the author of the bill in order to discuss and have open and freewheeling discussion. It's good to have everyone prepared for every piece of legislation, but nevertheless, those of us in the minority, we don't necessarily have the same resources and tools as what the majority party has, and sometimes amendments are the only tool we have. And we, as I said on the floor in the Senate, we reserve the right to exercise amendment drafting and introductions.
Senator,
we are trying to do it, in a way to make a troublesome atmosphere, but that is our right to do here.
Well, Senator Limmer, as the chair of this committee, we are not a committee comprising of majority and minority members. We are state senators who sit on the Judiciary Committee. I intend to run this committee in a bipartisan manner, giving all of our members every opportunity to bring up their bills, as well as giving an opportunity for members in this committee to be heard. And so just for members, I mean, we are the Senate, and this is the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. It is not a committee of minority or majority members. And keep that in mind as we do our work. Senator
Betzel. Oh, just, Madam Chair, Senator Lieberman, remarks that were made yesterday on the Senate floor did not reflect the views of any other members except those who spoke on that particular bill. And I can actually tell you that the majority leader, who sits right next to me, was quite surprised when he said, amendments are always in order. In fact, if you've got a good amendment, I want to hear about it. So there is certainly no interest or desire to prevent anybody from offering appropriate amendments. In fact, I was looking through that bill yesterday saying, okay, the challenge has been raised. I'm going to find something to offer an amendment on. I couldn't. It was so technical, I didn't understand what was in there. But I tried.
Senator Higgins, we apologize for straying off of what's on the agenda. Senate File 300, Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have Senate File 300, which is brought to us by the Board of Public Defense. To my left is Laura Budd, who is the chair of the State Board of Defense. And to my other left is Kevin Kyer, who's the chief administrator for the board. Madam Chair, to start with, I have the A1 amendment, which I think can be an author's amendment. Mr. Backus realized that when he was working on this, he found these items that needed to be taken care of as well.
I understand, Senator Higgins, that this is an author's amendment, and so the A1 amendment is the author's amendment to put the bill in the condition that the author desires before she presents the bill to us. Senator Higgins, move the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion is adopted. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will turn it over to Mr. Kyer and Chair Budd.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As Senator Higgins said, I'm Laura Budd, and I chair the Minnesota State Board of Public Defense. We are a 7-member board. 4 members are appointed by the judiciary, and 3 are public members who are appointed by the governor. In October, the board had a planning session where we looked at a variety of aspects pertaining to the board. And at that meeting, in our December meeting, we addressed some of the housekeeping issues. And the bill that is before you now is that housekeeping issue. The primary purpose of this bill is to make corrections to the statutes so that they conform to the Minnesota Supreme Court decisions, statutory changes which have been made by the legislature, actual practices in court, and some of the board administrative changes. So I thank you, and I will turn it over to Kevin.
Mr. Kyer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the chief administrator for the Board of Public Defense. I know that it's getting late, and I'll go as quickly as I can through the sections and kind of highlight a couple of them where you may have had some contact from folks or some discussion. So, Madam Chair, as Board Member Budd indicated, we're really trying to conform the statutes to the recent Supreme Court decisions and also update those statutes. And so as we go through this, I'll reference some of those as they come up. Section 1, Madam Chair, strikes a reference to the public defender copayment in the Revenue Recapture Act. As you all may recall, in this case of State versus Keenan, the Supreme Court ruled that public defender copayment was unconstitutional. In Section 2, it strikes language that the state public defender had some discretion, or the appellate office, I should say, to represent folks in a post-conviction remedy. That's the case of State versus Deegan. And in that case, or in that issue, the legislature had provided that office with some discretion where a defendant had pled to a downward departure and said that the office could then exercise some discretion in whether or not they were going to take that appeal. In Deegan, the court indicated that that wasn't the case, that everybody had had a right to that first appeal. Section 3 strikes the language again relating to the copayment. It also prohibits the public defender or the court from charging a copayment of any kind. Prior to the mandatory copayment, which was passed 4 years ago, there was a $28 copayment that was in place. In talking to the folks at the Department of Finance over the last months before the session, it was our belief and our indication that that money was being held pending some kind of resolution on the Supreme Court decision, but also whether or not folks would be asking for a refund for that money. So what's in the bill now is to eliminate that. It's interesting to note that in that case, the court did not specifically reinstate the language of the $28 copayment. It did specifically reinstate language in some of its other decisions, and so the intent here is not to create a hole in the general fund, but was to kind of follow the dictates of that Supreme Court decision. Madam Chair, Section 4 corrects a reference to the definition of income related to child support, and it's not related to child support. It's related to the reimbursement of public defense costs by some clients, and I think the amendment that you all just passed puts that into the kind of shape that I think Senate counsel feels is correct. That was an issue actually that came from the revisor's office to us, and apparently they've now agreed that the language that you've adopted works a little better. Section 5 strikes language related to a former member of the State Board of Public Defense. This was a judge that was on the board. This dates back to, I believe, 1992 or 3, and just said that that once that term was over, there would be no more judges appointed to the board, and obviously that hasn't happened since then. Section 6 restores the appointment of the chief administrator to the Board of Public Defense rather than the state public defender. Again, this goes back at least 13 years, I guess, something like that, and again was one of those issues where prior to state assumption we had a separate state public defender entity and a separate state board entity. Section 7 removes existing language related to the duties of the public defender. Again, as we move down the list, we are trying to conform this to what actual practice is, which is our deputy state public defender and hopefully chief appellate defender is the actual one that runs that office and provides those services. Again, Section 8 renames the deputy state public defender as the chief appellate defender, provides for appointment by the board for a 4-year term. This is the same term that all of our district chief public defenders have. The incumbent is supportive of this change. And so again, as Board Member Budd pointed out, this is one of those issues that came up at the planning session in terms of realigning the appointment process along with the kind of functions that go on.
Mr. Kyer?
Yes.
May I ask a question here? I'm trying to, this is not creating a new position with future salary implications, correct?
Madam Chair, correct. There is a deputy state public defender now who does that work. Frankly, we don't have a deputy state public defender. We have a chief of the appellate office. So we're putting into the statute what the existing practice is.
Thank you.
Putting in the term.
Please continue.
Section 9, Madam Chair, removes again the discretion of the chief appellate defender to decline representation. That was again related to that Supreme Court decision. Section 10 updates the terms for the chief public defenders. Again, we have to do that periodically. Section 11 provides that if the court appoints advisory or standby counsel, that the county in which the proceedings are held must pay for that attorney. Now, this may be one of the issues that folks have visited with you about. That is a case of State versus Clark. In that case, the trial judge saw that the statute prohibited him from appointing the public defender as advisory counsel. That case was appealed, that issue was appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that the trial judge had erred in not appointing advisory counsel, but was silent on the issue of who pays for the advisory counsel. The legislature 4 years ago passed a statute that prohibited us from providing that advisory council. The counties currently pay for this service, and so all we're doing is clarifying after that Supreme Court decision that in fact is what's going on, and to, again, clear up any confusion. Section 12 strikes language that the district defenders may engage in the general practice of law if they're not full-time. They are all full-time. This language dates back to the early 90s, I guess it was, when we did have part-time chief public defenders. Section 15 removes a reference to public defender reimbursement. It's covered in another section of the statute. It leaves intact the reimbursement for appointed counsel, which may occur in civil cases or some other issue where somebody's asked for reimbursement. And finally, Madam Chair, Section 16 repeals a subdivision relating to, again, reimbursement, where the court was supposed to look at how many hours a defender put in and charge reimbursement based on a $40 per hour rate. This is a provision Senator Neville actually dealt with several years ago. We visited with him about it. It's very rarely, if ever, used, and frankly, the complaint has been that that amount is probably not realistic given the costs of attorneys these days. And it really isn't being used. The court uses its discretion, and frankly, we trust the court to use their discretion in those cases. So I know that was very quick, but again, Madam Chair, I know you're short on time, so we'd stand for any questions the committee might have.
Mr. Cairo, we have plenty of time, so don't worry about that on our behalf. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cairo on just the bill? Can you briefly reference the A1 amendment in the presentation?
Oh,
we didn't have an explanation of that.
Sure. Madam Chair, and it's for much smarter people than I am, and you got one of them sitting to your right, so but I'll go through it. Section 9 is merely an oversight where we reference the chief appellate public defender. We reference it in the bill, but this was one section of the statutes which we didn't find. In Section 2, if I'm reading this correctly, Madam Chair, Section 590.05 references again the presumptive sentence. Again, that was a section which we hadn't seen, which Senate counsel caught in terms of that ability or the discretion of the state public defender on those appeals. If you look at line 18, the net income, again, is a correction to that statute relative to child support and conforms it to the rest of that statute. And on line 21, again, is a section related to the chief appellate defender, again, which is, it was an oversight in the drafting. So they fit very nicely, obviously, with what we're trying to do.
We have people here to testify in opposition to the bill, but before we get there, I want to make sure that the members have had an opportunity to get a clear understanding of what the bill is about. Any questions to Mr. Cairo? All right. Let's see. It says here there's a representative from Minnesota Inter-County Association. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Senator Ma, members. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 8 greater Minnesota counties with either large cities or experiencing rapid growth, and the 5 collar counties here in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. I guess I'm here today along with John Kingry from the County Attorneys Association to at least ask the committee to give further deliberations or pass this bill on to Finance Committee to consider its fiscal implications. Mr. Cairo has said that counties pay for this currently. We first became of this provision at the very end of last week and have been in the process of finding out from our members as to what their understanding of current practices are.
And Mr. Carlson, I'm going to interrupt you. Members, just for your references, Mr. Carlson is referring to Section 11 of the bill on page 9. Please continue.
Madam Chair, thank you. And quite frankly, we're getting conflicting stories. Two of our counties have told them, we've never heard of this, we've never paid for this, and three others have said, yes, we have paid for this in the past. What further causes this concern is the history of the financing of the state public defenders. Has those of you with some history here know the state took over the funding of the public defenders in 1991? At that time, for the state's cost of that assumption, it was had heretofore essentially been paid for the counties with local property tax dollars. We suffered a dollar-for-dollar offset in our homestead and agricultural credit aid for the cost of that transfer. To the extent that these costs for standby counsel was in the base that was used for that computation or that transfer, we believe, frankly, we've already paid for this. So we're concerned that this cost is now being placed back on us. I will further point out that under current law, $500,000 of our county program aid, or what's analogous to the city's LGA that you or local government aid that you might be more familiar with, is set aside each year for the Board of Public Defense to bill against for the cost of public defense that cannot be provided by the Board of Public Defense and where there's court-appointed counsel. So we have further questions as to whether or not that does not already take care of this issue. I guess I'd say, frankly, just a final comment, the holding in Clark, I think Mr. Kier represented accurately, but I'll just further point out the court did not find the defect so bad as to overturn the actual conviction of the individual. So the impact of the case in the assignment of standby counsel I don't think is particularly great. In fact, it goes in the other direction, has to somewhat limit the court's obligation to do that for those individuals who choose in an informed manner to make that selection. So again, members, I would ask you to at least give us the opportunity to have further discussions with the Public Defender's Office and possibly facilitate that by passing this bill on to the Finance Committee, which would also facilitate further identifications of the fiscal impact.
Mr. Carlson, just so that you know, this bill is on its way to the, if the committee so desire and it should pass out of this committee, it will go to the Finance Committee. Mr. Carlson, what do you make of on page 9, line 917 and 918, the sentence that says the district public defender must not serve as advisory counsel? I understand that that is also interspersed throughout other sections of the statute, and in fact that's the rationale for the new language on lines 921 to line 24.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kier correctly enlightened the commission that they were successful back in 2003 in getting language into the statute that said public defenders could not be appointed as advisory standby counsel. At the time, I guess, frankly, counties were so shell-shocked by all the other shifts of services and costs that were being put on them, one that you're certainly familiar with is short-term offenders, that this one frankly got by us. Again, as I mentioned, when these services were taken over by the state in 1990, our understanding is these costs were, our services were routinely provided by the public defender, and it was in the base that determined our HACA cuts. So again, we're a little bit frustrated that now these costs are being forced back on us.
Mr. Kier, perhaps you can come back up to the table.
Mr. Kyra, if the counties were successful in striking the paragraph B from this bill, does that mean that we will have to go into the statutes and remove the sentence I reference on line 917 to line 18?
Madam Chair and members, I think what would happen, let's say if that section was ultimately stricken from the bill, you would end up with that, again, with that confusion out there among the 300 judges and all of the rest of the folks as to, again, who pays for this. I think the legislature 4 years ago was very clear, and now what we're trying to do is say, you know what, let's make it clear to the court. The court in Clark ended up deciding that it was the prerogative of the court whether or not to appoint standby or advisory counsel. It's our belief that the legislature is the one that decides who pays for that. And so I think it's, for us, it's a matter of clarifying this so our individual defenders don't have to fight this issue before 301 judges.
I guess I'm just, Mr. Kyra and members, I'm struggling a little bit that maybe I haven't been a practitioner in a long time, and the fact that the public defender would be specifically named as not being appointed to serve as advisory counsel is a little bit concerning for me. I thought that they were public defenders were sort of when you have no other places to go, the public defenders is where you end up. And so I'm concerned about that in the law to begin with. Any thoughts on that?
Madam Chair, sure. There are a host of other places where in the statute where folks have the right to counsel that doesn't necessarily involve a public defender. This is obviously one of them. The court can appoint advisory counsel, private counsel, and appointed counsel, and paid for by either the court budget or the counties. Civil commitments. We don't do civil commitments, although there have been judges who have been trying to get us to do some of that work. That's a county function that's done on an appointed counsel basis. Private CHIPS petitions. There are a number of these places in the statute that allow for appointed counsel.
I guess I'm concerned that in the rules of criminal procedure, is it specific about who can or cannot be appointed as advisory counsel?
Madam Chair, I would defer to one of my chief public defenders, Bill Ward, the chief public defender of the 10th Judicial District is here, and I think he could answer that for you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is William Ward. I'm the Chief Public Defender of the 10th Judicial District. Your question is regarding the rules of criminal procedure and whether or not it denotes whether our office is the office that should be appointed. I would ask the members of this committee, in reading that criminal rule, in all the sections that it talks about appointment of public defender, it actually uses the phrase district public defender. When it talks about and what it's written about regarding standby or advisory counsel, the phrase district public defender is never used. And in fact, it talks about that the court may appoint advisory counsel but does not state the district public defender shall be that advisory counsel. So although I understand the ruling in Clark states in some dicta that our office should be the office perhaps being appointed because there's a conflict in the rule and the statute, a true reading of that statute shows that they are not indeed in conflict as far as the written rule itself.
So in application, if what you're proposing in this section were to go into effect, and the court should choose to exercise its discretion to appoint advisory or standby counsel, who would they appoint?
Madam Chair and members, what they do now, in the rare instances that they do this, is they appoint public defenders that the county pays for. I'll give you an example. As the chief of the 10th district, one of the counties I'm responsible for is Anoka. In that county, they have public defenders on a county basis to deal with mental health commitments, Ron Greenlee. In Sherburne County, I'm responsible for that county as well. Pat Fugina, who's a public defender assigned to the state office, is also working on a contract as a public defender for Sherburne County to deal with mental health commitments and other issues as well. So the counties have lawyers they go to on these appointments when, in fact, the state office is not obligated to fulfill these appointment functions. They have those people built in now.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify, Mr. Kyer, the public defender here, is correct that there are instances such as civil commitments where we are required by law to provide that. But the way in which the counties manage that varies substantially. Some, such as Anoka, have a ongoing contract or retainer with a specific group of attorneys to provide that subject. But many other counties do it sort of on a case-by-case basis. They may negotiate a fee ahead of time, or it may just be, frankly, out of the blue. And I'll be frank with you, you know, we're frustrated that we have to pay for those costs too, but we know that's the current state of the law. We have a much larger disagreement with the public defenders regarding representation and CHIPS, where we believe that the obligation rests with them. And as perhaps the committee knows, the board has a very large appropriation request to fulfill what we believe is their obligation of that area, and we're supportive of that. But again, we just don't want to see further costs being shifted back onto us.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I think we should move to the heart of this, and because that's where the money is, and it seems to me that that we haven't really addressed who provides the money, either the state through the public defender's office or the counties. Can we focus on that and see where that takes us?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if I'm to respond to that. What we're talking about, as most of us here know, are very few cases. I can come up with three cases that's happened in the last 5 months, one in Wright County, one in Sherburne County, one in Anoka County, where the county is responsible for having appointed advisory or substitute counsel. Other than that, in the past 4 years, there have been very few cases that a lawyer has been appointed that has been paid by the county in the instance or the examples we're talking about for advisory or substitute counsel. So as far as the money part of it from our agency, to fulfill those obligations, I mean, the issue for us, obviously, is we have so many cases. We have double the standards that we should have according to the ABA. What we're trying to do is be as effective and efficient as possible in the cases we should be doing by Constitution and state mandates and not be responsible for the statutory mandates regarding other types of appointments such as advisory counsel. Hopefully that answers the question.
Well, Mr. Warden, that raises the same concern for me, is that if there aren't that many cases, then why is the Board of the Public Defenders not willing to take the cases? Any other members would like to ask any other questions? Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I think while the case number may not be that high, there's a tendency for that to escalate and create a specific need that isn't paid for.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, if I may, committee members, what we're talking about on these advisory councils, substitute councils, we're talking about trials. In fact, a person is either representing himself pro se, and the court has decided that the person either isn't sufficiently capable of handling the trial and the endurance of doing a trial, or the court is asking a lawyer to be appointed on a substitute counsel basis in the middle of trial and just take it over with no research and no ability to understand what we're doing. What happens is that these are cases that obviously are sometimes strident and very difficult individuals to deal with. These are cases that are, in fact, laborious in nature, and they take a lot of time and personnel for our agency to be involved in these matters when we're appointed last minute. This is something that happens that the court sees that this may be something that's a difficult process. And in order for us to help facilitate the court or facilitate this case through the court system, we get appointed last minute to take care of the problem. And that is very, very time-consuming, not only for a lawyer in my office, but for our support staff, paralegals, legal secretaries, for the managing attorney. We then, at the last minute, have to rearrange schedules and calendars and handle cases that the attorney who's been appointed to represent no longer can handle on him or herself. Somebody else has to do these things. So there is an effect on the system to us, and it's a very time-consuming process for us to be involved in these last minute.
Well, I mean, I used to think, though, that if all else fails, our public at least has access, our public defenders. And it certainly sounds like I'm sympathetic that your caseload is such that it sounds like we're working to not give people access to you. Actually, anyone else want to comment on the
Madam Chair,
Neville?
I'm sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, I think your initial thought is correct. And I have two questions, I guess. So when we put this language in that's on 9.18, where we said the district defender may not or must not serve as advisory, first of all, there's no legal or philosophical reason we put that in there. It was purely a financial consideration, wasn't it?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, that was strictly an issue of workload.
And so when we put that in there, we knew that the effect of that was that the counties would be appointing the lawyers and paying for them. We just didn't say that explicitly.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville,
Kier.
That's correct. And to go back to a reference that I think Mr. Carlson made, we have had this discussion, at least with his associate, Mr. Tuma, 4 years ago.
So then
and, I mean,
my second question
Senator
is,
Neville.
When we put that language in there, what do you recall telling us was the fiscal impact of that?
Taking it away
from you.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, we talked to with all of you in terms of, I think, as Mr. Ward pointed out, the workload and the issues related to the office. You know, we're talking about, you know, and I defer to you, maybe 50 or 100 cases a year, I think, is what we talked about 4 years ago. But again, as Mr. Ward indicated, they tended to be those cases that were last minute that ended up being 2 or 3 week trials or a week long trial. And for us to take somebody out of the rotation when we're handling, you know, 800 case units or 750 case units per lawyer was a really difficult thing, especially in Mr. Ward articulates it much better than I could about the last minute issues and involving paralegals and all the other folks. So,
well, Madam Chair,
Senator Neville,
even if somebody else is appointed, they're being taken out of their rotation too. But I guess if it's 50 to 100 cases, what's the value of that? Is it a million? Is it 3 million? Do you remember telling us back then what impact you thought it would have?
Sakaya?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I, and again, this is going back 4 years, I don't believe we had the discussion in terms of dollar amounts. We had that discussion in terms of workload and in terms of the impact, especially in the rural areas, where, as you know, we have part-time public defenders who are then going to be called in to do this, and what happens to the calendar in the next county because we have to pull somebody in? What happens to the calendar down the hall because we have to pull somebody out of that courtroom to deal with this issue?
Well, one more question, then, Madam Chair. If we gave you money, there's no legal or philosophical reason you can't do it. It's purely a money issue from your perspective, isn't it?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I think that discussion's gone on internally with our office, is that if once somebody refuses, should we be providing standby or advisory counsel? I think there's a difference of opinion internally on that issue. Because once somebody's, decided that they don't want us, should we be appointed? We don't currently, as a practice, allow people to say, gee, I don't like Bill Ward, so I'd like a different lawyer. The fact that you don't like Mr. Ward isn't a good enough reason for us to say we're now going to appoint Mr. Neville as your public defender. You can imagine the domino effect that might have if we started doing that. And so as a practice, we don't allow that to happen. If there's a conflict, obviously that's something different. So,
Mr. Kier, are there other provisions in this bill? what I'm hearing is that there's some concerns on the part of the public defenders in terms of workload. Are there other provisions of this bill that also addresses sort of workload reduction in order to make your workload manageable?
Madam Chair, no. I think the rest of them are purely things that, like I say, conform to either Supreme Court decisions or updating the statutes to reflect what actual practice is. So that's the only one.
Any other discussion from members?
Mr. Madam Chair, if I might, because there are a couple of issues that Mr. Carlson brought up and has gone on, and I would like to respond to them. At the time of the state takeover, he's correct that the counties did give up the state. The legislature also appropriated, and I don't recall the exact figure, but it was several million dollars that the legislature appropriated to get that assumption of at the state level. So there was a combination of things that went on. So you folks did step up to the plate in terms of doing that, and I wanted to just make that clear. Secondly, he referenced the contingency fund that we have. As you all know, because we've talked to most of you about our transcript problem, we expend that contingency budget every year either on the large cases that we have or on our transcript budget. Last year we had a $300,000 budget for transcript, and we just testified in front of Senator Foley's committee earlier today. We spent $821,000 on transcripts last year. So that, while that contingency fund is there, it is routinely expended and expended quite early. And lastly, and I know that, Madam Chair, you don't want to get involved in this issue right now. I think it'll discussion we're going to have at some point is on the CHIPS issue is the representation of parents in CHIPS cases is a county responsibility under 260C.331. So we're appreciative of Mr. Carlson and the county's support on our budget request, and we would love to be able to do that work if we had the resources. But it is a county responsibility, at least by statute. So.
I understand that Mr. Kingery was going to testify. Is he here? Does he want to speak? Or is his position covered by Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, John Kingery on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and Mr. Carlson did I think articulate a number of the concerns that we have, and I simply want to make some remarks regarding some of the feedback that I've gotten from some of our folks. I mean, clearly, the cost shift issue, the shift on the local level, is one of a major concern. I think just very, very briefly, we just need to step back and talk about our system of justice. And as you know, it's basically a three-legged stool. It's the courts, it's the public defenders, and it's the county attorneys or city attorneys, the prosecutors. In order to have a good, robust system of justice, those three legs of that stool need to be funded. And I think that's an issue that, unfortunately, Senator Higgins is going to have to grapple with it at some point in the very near future. But
Senator
Senator Foley. Okay, well, I guess you'll be dealing with that, Senator Foley. But that's something that needs to be addressed. A lot of this discussion so far has been one of economics. As you know, we moved to our state-funded public defender system a number of years ago to shift costs away from counties. But I think more importantly, to make sure that there's better uniformity and professionalism on defense services to the indigent in our state. The typical case that's been reported to me is a case where someone's been appointed a public defender and they don't have a meeting of the minds of the public defender, they don't get along, they don't like the strategy, whatever, and because that doesn't get resolved, the client may dismiss or discharge that public defender on the eve of trial or very close to trial. And apparently, again, just sort of paraphrasing the feedback that I've received, that the public defender's office won't reassign a case based on the request of a client, and so therefore the person gets discharged by that particular client. These are individuals that are eligible for public services, public defender services, paid for by the state, This proposal, as it's been viewed by a couple of our folks, would allow them to receive a new attorney, which is not a person from the public defender's office, at county expense. And this opens the door, again, according to their view, to attorney shopping, which is something that I think we would all have some concern with. It's the responsibility of the public defender's office to provide this representation, and we believe that if the statute needs to be clarified, it should be clarified. As I believe I heard earlier, one of the reasons this language was put in advisory council and so forth was in part to relieve some of the burden from the public defender budget because of the cuts that they were forced to absorb a number of years ago. Maybe it's time to revisit that issue and take that language back out and have a discussion on the cost of running this program. Another suggestion is in county attorneys where there's a conflict of interest, the county attorney will usually shop around, call his or her neighbor county attorney and see if there isn't some way that they would possibly take that case where there's a conflict. And one suggestion has been that a system, I'm not saying it's easy, I'm not saying it wouldn't be administratively difficult, but a system where there is a conflict, a system of cooperation among the different districts that are out there. So when there is a case like this, they could find another another public defender on a fairly short basis. And the question is, we do it, why can't they do it as a suggestion? I don't know. It's probably in procedure. The language about paying reasonable compensation, I'm not sure exactly what that is. And I do know early on one of our folks, and I will get some additional information, one of our assistants here in the metro area had some concern about removing Section 16, that $40 thing, which I admit is probably used very, very rarely. But we do have the concern that what is the ceiling on this stuff? And again, the impact that ultimately has on local units of government, ultimately the property tax base.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kingery? Mr. Kyer, I'm glad that you're coming back on to the table. I have one last question for you. On page 4, line 433 to 434, can you explain the rationale for that new language?
Madam Chair, page 4?
Yes.
Line
433, 434?
Yes. Court case. Madam Chair and members, as I mentioned earlier, the court, in its decision on the mandatory copayments, declared that those copayments were unconstitutional. It did not specifically reinstate the language of the prior copayment, the $28 waivable copayment. And some counties are, from what we have heard, or I should say some courts, are judges are ordering that, some are not. And frankly, if the court, in fact, didn't reinstate that language, there's no statutory authority to go ahead and do that. So the board's position was we'd like to see that practice eliminated if, in fact, there's no statutory authority to do it and make it clear that it shouldn't be ordered. So,
members, Senator Foley might want to take a closer look at this in his committee. Sure. I just want to raise it to the members for your attention. Is there, Mr. Kyer?
Madam Chair, again, I hate to prolong this, but I do have to respond to Mr. Kingery, and I appreciate his position. But let me just respond to two things very quickly. The issue of lawyer shopping, is not an issue in this case. These are folks who are, again, representing themselves, not trying to get another lawyer out of either the county or the public defender's office, because it is standby counsel. Secondly, on the issue of reimbursement, there is no impact to the local units of government. This is merely a paragraph that was put into the statute to determine how much reimbursement would go to the individual public or to the public defenders. That money is then dispersed to part-time public defenders based on the amount that is collected in each judicial district to offset their overhead. It has no impact on appointed counsel. It has no impact on local units of government. That's strictly an issue of the part-time public defenders.
Any other members of the audience who would like to testify on this bill?
As admitted. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I need a little bit more explanation on that repealer. Why are we taking out the section about the $40 an hour, the reimbursement rate? Sure.
Mr. Kyer.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, we were taking it out because in most instances it's not used. It's very rarely, if ever, used. We do not keep track of attorney hours by individual case. We keep it by case type, but lawyers don't keep it, you know, on individual cases. And you might imagine with 176,000 cases a year, there's a good reason for that. Secondly is that if, in fact, you did have reimbursement, the concern among at least some prosecutors that I've talked to is, and other folks, is that $40 an hour is too low. And so we've said, you know what, let's just take it out and leave it to the discretion of the judges. We've had a few instances where judges have tried to use it, and we've said we just can't provide you the information. So it's not an attempt to get rid of reimbursement. It's just saying, you know what, we're not using it anyway.
Any further discussions on Senate File 300 as amended?
Madam
Senator
Chair.
Foley.
Senator Higgins, I think you've got a dilemma here. Most of what I see that's solvable is stuff that will have to come to my committee and to resolve the fiscal part of it. And to go back and forth, it just strikes me as that we've reached about as far as we can, and I don't know whether it's appropriate that we do it, but I would suggest that we send the thing to the Finance Committee without recommendation.
Senator Higgins, any thoughts on Senator Foley's?
Is the reason it's going to the Finance Committee, Madam Chair, just that one provision that everybody's been arguing about?
Well, Senator Higgins, we didn't really spend a substantial amount of time on it, but there is the issue of the striking of the co-pays. I think that creates a little bit of a hole, and so there has to be some discussions about the implications of that. I mean, I didn't engage ask questions because I thought that's more appropriate for the Finance Committee to consider.
But
you know, members, we are a policy committee, and what I would like is for us to make a decision before we send it to the Finance Committee. They certainly could choose to undo what we've done here if that's the will of that committee based on what the financial implications are. But you know, my inclination is that I would like us to make a decision, and I think that decision is that in approving this, the policy decision is that we then do shift that cost onto the county based on this new language, and so I think that we should, you know, talk about that, and I think we should make that decision. And again, if once it gets to your committee, Senator Foley, if in that discussion you should choose to change that, I think that I certainly won't pull the bill back, but I think that we're the policy committee and we need to have that discussion and send this on with a vote. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, it strikes me that Section 11, the new language, is just clarifying what we intended to do when we added that language on line 18. If that's the way we interpret it, then there isn't a fiscal impact. It's nothing but clarification, because the counties should have been paying it already, and we're just underscoring that. If, however, we disagree that the counties ought to be paying and that the public defenders should, then the proper thing would be to delete that sentence on line 18, and then it would have a fiscal impact and should go to Senator Foley's Finance Committee.
Well, Senator Neville,
right analysis?
Correct on this section, but I would still go to Senator Neville's committee anyways, because the
Foley's. Are there some other things that have fiscal
other sections?
Too?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Section 3.
I believe Section 3 eliminates the public defender copayment.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And, so and we can't anyway. Do anything about that, Senator Neville, because it was ruled unconstitutional. So that will have to be addressed in Senator Foley's committee.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I have two questions, I guess. when did we make the move to for the state to pay the costs instead of the counties?
For the public defender?
Or did we not? Just
for standby counsel?
Was that what it was for? Was it just for standby counsel? I just need a little history here. Somebody referenced the state payment, and also it would be helpful to me to hear this quantified. What does it mean in Hennepin County?
Senator Scheid, are you asking for a little bit of history
with respect to the
prohibition, what we have in statute stating that the district public defender must not serve as advisory counsel?
No, but I thought Mr. Carlson talked about the state taking over some costs, and that would be helpful to me to hear that.
Mr. Carlson, I think Senator Scheid is referencing when the state took over the public defender cost.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, the transition from county to local funding occurred in our calendar year 1991. And again, as I said, the mechanics of it was the state appropriated for the money that was no longer paid by the counties, but then our Homestead and Agricultural Credit Aid was reduced by a corresponding amount, so there was no net cost to the state for the simple transition. And this, again, prior to 2003, these costs were assumably in the public defender's base. So, again, our concern is we've already sort of paid for it.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, and to anyone who would have this information, if you do, because it seems as though this rarely happens, does anyone know exactly on an annual basis how much money we're talking about? And then just a procedure question, since I'm new to this process, Madam Chair, is it possible to make a recommendation subject to, for example, if we were to want to approve this, provided that additional funding was recommended, can we make it our recommendation subject to providing that additional funding?
Senator Olson, I don't think that we should
do that
as a committee, engage in tying the hands of Senator Foley's committee with our recommendations. Can anybody answer the first question with respect to the numbers? I mean, my understanding is that because we're not the finance committee, you know, there was no fiscal note drawn up, but that there aren't that many cases and the numbers are not definitive. Mr. Kier, do you?
Madam Chair and members, on the issue of the fiscal note, again, the counties have already been paying this cost for the last 4 years, so we're really not, as Senator Neville indicated, it's not a new cost to them in terms of now doing this. This is something that happened 4 years ago. In terms of the number of cases, again, we're looking at probably, 100 cases statewide. And in terms of the costs, I just mentioned to Mr. Carlson, is you probably don't have an idea because each county operates differently in terms of how they, what they pay, how many cases there might be, all those things. To respond to Senator Scheid's issue on Hennepin County, the county pays a significant portion of the public defender costs in Hennepin, so that's already included in the budget there or as part of that. So,
members, I think that we have heard and discussed enough on the issue. I am open to Senator Foley's suggestion, although my preference is that we do take a vote on this, and Senator Foley, we will send it to your committee, and I think at that time, perhaps the stakeholders could work with Mr. Turner to try to develop some numbers for that committee's consideration. Senator Neville.
Now, Madam Chair, maybe we could make a policy decision, though, on Section 11. But, my memory's a little fuzzy from 4 years ago, but that was the real bad budget year, and I'm sure that this was some, the public defender was stretched. They always are. And they were looking at ways to save money. But from a policy point of view, I think it's better that the public defenders do it. And I think you were alluding to that before, too. And I don't know. I won't make a motion unless somebody else agrees with me from a policy point of view. But my suggestion would be that we delete the new language and delete that sentence that says the public defenders don't do it, and put it back to having the public defenders do it. Advice. And then we send it to Senator Foley's committee and see if he can come up with the money.
Yeah.
And hope that he can come up with the money.
And then if there's no money.
But from a policy point of view, I would argue that the public defenders are the better people to be providing standby counsel. Does anybody agree with me on that? Or, I mean, I'm not going to move it unless others agree.
Kind of do.
Mr. Backus, Senator Betzel.
Well, I was just wondering if any of the witnesses had any thoughts on that.
Mr. Carlson, Mr. Kingery, Mr. Kyer.
Well, we know how Mr. Carlson feels about that.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, we support the additional appropriation.
Mr. Kyer.
Well, that's not the question.
And Madam Chair, that's why I was asking Mr. Kyer, is there any legal or philosophical objection to doing it? And frankly, I didn't find the answer that compelling. It was, lawyer shopping or something like that. But,
Madam Chair?
Mr. Ward.
I understand the position of Senator Neville, but the reality is our public defenders are doing it now. The reality is that the part-time lawyers in many of the outstate counties are the people that are appointed by the county to represent these people on an advisory or substitute counsel basis. So if you're concerned regarding the expertise of the lawyers, they basically are state public defenders doing this on a private basis. So if there, again, a concern expertise and the ability to handle these cases on a policy standpoint, we have that in place. The other thing is the other policy issue, and Senator, you agree with this, is the caseloads that we have. It would seem to me that the better policy would be someone who could be appointed to handle these cases that don't have 7 cases set for a jury trial on a Monday, and those don't go, so they have to do a standby case for another client. The better policy would be to have a private counsel either that currently has a contract with the public defender or the county as a public defender who has substantially less cases to handle them than the folks in my current state office. So I appreciate your position on that, but as far as the expertise, those lawyers are in place. They are the ones who are currently doing it for the county and are being paid for by the county as standby and advisory counsel.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
I don't accept that argument. I mean, private lawyers have caseloads too. All lawyers have caseloads, and if they're going to be appointed as standby, they're going to have to put stuff aside. The real question here is that you just need money. You need to hire a few more lawyers to be able to handle the standby caseload. So I'm just suggesting that the state public defender is the best organization to provide that when it's needed, and you got to go and persuade Senator Foley to give you some money to hire a few more.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I agree with what Senator Neville says. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do think that the public defender's office is the most appropriate agency to handle these cases as a policy matter, but on the other hand, they need the money to do it, and so we're set here when bouncing it to the county and then back, and it isn't the only thing in the court case. I mean, what I've got in there is a whole series of things that deal with the court system and the counties are paying a lot of that right now. Even though we shifted it over to the state and said we've gone that direction, the county provides the courthouses, they provide the deputies that are acting as bailiffs. They do a whole series of things that is an ongoing situation. So I look at it as no matter what we can do, that the only way we're going to do it is with some money. And I guess...
Senator Foley, that's your jurisdiction.
Yeah. Well, and I don't have the money. So. But I do think in the concept of having Senator Neville's idea outward, so that the that we really think that the public defenders ought to do that is a policy choice that you could make.
Senator Scheid, any thoughts? Please come to the table. Did you have your hands up? You don't have to speak.
No. I'm inclined to agree with Senator.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Dakota County Board of Commissioners. And it's my understanding that in Dakota County, our county does not pay these costs. And I'm sorry, I'm not an attorney. I don't practice law. I'm not in the courts. And I don't know why we don't pay it, but it's my understanding we do not pay this. It has occurred to me, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that I heard the leadership of the Senate step forward in the first opening days of the session saying property tax relief was one of the first six goals that the Senate wanted to accomplish this year. Right now, the legislature has given the authority to a variety of agencies to levy property taxes, and that's school districts and counties and cities and a variety of special districts, but they haven't allowed the public defenders to levy property taxes. This, in effect, is a property tax if the new language goes into effect that requires my county to start paying for this cost out of property taxes that are not currently paying. So as senators, I see you have a dilemma. You can put all the money you want into the little bucket that says property tax relief, but if this provision or other provisions come along and poke holes in that bottom of that bucket, money goes in one side and out the other. You're not going to get the property tax relief unless you make the decision not to pass these expenses on the property taxes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think that we've had sufficient discussion on the issue. We know where our dilemma lies.
Did Senator Neville's
motion?
Want
me to try a motion? Madam Chair? Senate Counsel, have you been tracking? Can you not propose it? Or should I try? Okay.
Senator Neville wishes to.
I can do it. I'd move to delete.
Senator Neville, Senate Counsel has been tracking.
Oh, okay. Why don't you go ahead and do that?
Madam Chair and members, I think you'd have to strike existing law in two places. I think you'd have to begin on page 4. Of the bill. Page 4, lines 8 to 9, strike the court must not appoint the district public defender as advisory counsel, period.
Where is that? What line?
That's page 4, lines 8 to 9. That's also existing law.
Okay.
And then turning to page 9, lines 17 to 18, strike the district public defender must not serve as advisory counsel, period. And then lines 21 to 24 of page 9, delete that new language.
I'd move that.
And also, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but lines 9.14, delete the new paragraph A.
I would move that.
Senator Neville moves that oral amendment. Any questions from members?
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, it's I know the argument of let's take this out of there, send it to Senator Foley's committee and try and find the money for it, but I know that the governor's budget funded not even 20% of what the public defenders asked for. This is going to then add on to that spread of what the public defenders believe they need to do a good job for the state that we're going to have to find the money for beyond what the governor recommended.
Well, Senator Higgins, if this amendment does prevail, I think that the opportunity will be given to you to see what the fiscal note or what the price tag looks like. And I think then that discussion in Senator Foley's committee would be more robust. Our discussion here, we're sort of operating on hypotheticals and with no concrete numbers. And so I think Once it gets to Senator Foley's committee and you have the numbers, certainly, you know, as a part of that committee, that discussion could take place. And if it is appropriate, I think this section could certainly be brought back in that committee. But I think that this committee has made a public policy decision. Well, in that amendment, I think the policy implication is that the public defender is the appropriate place. And I think that's the question that's on the table with that amendment. So is there further discussion? Senator Foley.
Well, and what you say is true, and I agree that the public defender's office should control that. But if we do that, we pass this amendment, that their opportunity to collect anything is non-existent, and they at least get the full cost of providing that kind of service. And you're going to say, well, why worry about that? Well, it's currently being paid by the counties, from what I can understand, and of course they want to get rid of it, and I don't blame them for that. But on the other hand, I support what Senator Neville has, I'm going to vote against it because I just think that it ties our hands.
All right. Any further discussions from the members?
I think we ought to have a roll call vote on that, Madam Chair.
A roll call vote has been requested. A roll call vote shall be taken.
Madam Chair, before we
Senator vote, Neville?
Just to underscore Senator Foley, it's not my intent to put any more burden on the public defense. Yeah. All I'm saying is that as a policy matter, they're the best organization to provide the lawyers, and if you can't come up with the money and find, if this passes and you can't come up, put it back in and make the counties pay, because that clearly was the intent 4 years ago.
What you say is true, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, but the fact is that you know that it doesn't work quite so easy to, once you've taken something out and then to try and take and put that back in, I'm not sure that it can be done.
Any further discussions? On the Neville amendment, the chair votes aye.
Nay.
Wait until you get called.
All right, Betzel?
Betzel, no.
Foley?
No.
Higgins?
No.
Limmer? Moi? Neville?
Yes.
Olson?
No.
Ortman and Scheid.
Yes.
In a vote of 3 ayes and 4 nays, the motion does not prevail. On Senate file 300, is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I would move that this bill, Senate File 300, be transferred to the Finance Committee without recommendation.
Madam Chair, I didn't hear what Senator Foley said.
Senator Higgins, Senator Foley has just moved your bill.
Without recommendation or with recommendation?
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation.
Madam Chair, that's a funny thing that we do here is we move things without recommendation, but we still move them. So, does it matter to who's, whether it's with or without, when we know it's going there anyway? Can't we just move the bill and vote on it without the recommendation or not recommend, without Senator Foley's last piece?
Senator Higgins, my inclination is I think this committee has spoken on the contentious issue, and I agree with you, but Senator Foley has put the motion on the table. I agree with you that we should just send it off with a recommendation, but let's have the members vote on that, and then if you so wish, you shall make your motion. On Senator Foley's motion to send Senate File 300 to Finance without a recommendation. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. Senator Higgins.
And Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 300 as amended be recommended to pass and go to Finance.
On Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, one other lesson from this situation. I just have to let you know that both sides of the stakeholders on this issue did come to talk to me. I asked that they meet with one another and try to work this out, and obviously they weren't able to do that. And so it was up to the will of this committee to do that work. I appreciate the attempt by both sides to try to resolve or bring a resolution, but I guess on this in this situation it had to come to the committee. And Senator Foley, we will anticipate your addressing this issue, although I have to say that I really do think that the public defenders is the right place, the appropriate place for this. So thank you very much, and the committee is adjourned.